Hello, this is Christopher Bandini, one of the new co-hosts of New Books in Psychoanalysis, and I'm here today with Dr. Sophia Richman. Dr. Richman is a psychologist and psychoanalyst licensed in New York and in New Jersey who has been practicing for over 40 years. She holds a PhD from NYU and a diplomate in psychoanalysis from the American Board of Professional Psychology. In addition to her private practice, Dr. Richman is a supervisor at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, where she completed her analytic training in 1975. A training and supervising analyst at the Center for Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis of New Jersey, and a faculty member of the Stephen Mitchell Center for Relational Studies. Dr. Richman has authored a number of journal articles and chapters in edited books on the subject of catastrophic trauma and autobiographical writing. She is the author of a book titled A Wolf in the Attic, The Legacy of a Hidden Child of the Holocaust, which is Routledge in 2002. She's the winner of the 2003 Award for Scholarship from the Jewish Women's Caucus of the Association for Women in Psychology. She's also a painter with several solo exhibitions behind her, as well as numerous group shows. And we're here to talk to her today about her book, Mended by the Muse, Creative Transformations of Trauma. So, Dr. Richman, the way we usually start is to ask, what led you to write this book?
Okay. This book was very much tied in with my personal experience with both trauma and with creativity. The book is about trauma and creativity, and I was inspired by childhood experiences with trauma. I was born into the Holocaust, and I survived in hiding. This is in Poland. And so during my earliest years, during my toddler years, I was in hiding. And the early trauma was, for many years, it sort of went underground. I mean, I was always aware of what I had lived through, but I eventually, through analysis, I came to see its impact on me. And creativity was always an outlet for me. One of the early experiences that I had that was a traumatic experience was during that time, my father was also hidden. I was hidden in plain sight with my mother, so that we passed as Catholics. So we were out in the open. My mother had false identity papers, and she played the role of a Christian woman with a child. In the meantime, my father had been in a concentration camp, and he escaped. And when he escaped, we were hiding him in our attic, and I was told that there was danger in the attic. There was a wolf in the attic, which is, you know, you mentioned my first book, my memoir.
Yes.
And that was my title, A Wolf in the Attic. And I had to keep the secret of his existence from the rest of the world. So this was... I've come to see that this was really one of my early traumas. The fear of speaking, the danger of speaking, I could have given away his presence, and I had to lie about him. So it was terrifying, and it had an impact on my ability to speak. In fact, my speaking with you today.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly anxious for me. Speaking has always been anxiety-provoking, and particularly public speaking, but not necessarily just public speaking. There's a sense of having to be very careful about what I say, but writing was a whole different story. I feel much safer when I write, and painting also. So I was drawn to the creative arts. So to answer your question in the long way round, what inspired me to write this book was my life.
Yes, and in the book you're very forthcoming, and just as you have been just now in in how your personal journey has influenced your work, and there's a lot of talk in the book about self-disclosure.
Yes, there is. Well, writing a memoir, which I did about 12 years ago, I started it about, I guess, 14 years ago, was something that, you know, really brought me out there in the world. And I was trained back in the days when self-disclosure was a very complicated and pretty much, you know, not accepted. You know, the tide has changed, and there's a lot more openness among analysts. But self-disclosure became something that was I had to give a lot of thought to, both before publishing the book and since. So I have written on that subject as well.
It's interesting. There has been some recent writing or people coming towards the relational school saying that that the self-disclosure of the analyst is based on their anxiety to not be able to contain or to sit with the silence, which I don't agree with. But it's kind of interesting that it's coming, in a sense, it's almost coming full circle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, I'm not sure what you mean by full circle. Are you talking about the importance of still being able to maintain the silence when it's necessary, and that self-disclosure can actually interfere with that? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I think of some people coming maybe more from a one-person psychology, thinking that it's being careful about the self-disclosure coming from the therapist's anxiety rather than.
Yes. But, you know, I think that, you know, these old ideas sort of coexist along with some of the newer ones.
Yes.
you know, it's not surprising that you hear both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little about how you describe in the book the relational viewpoints of trauma as contrasted with maybe more of the traditional views?
Well, I'm particularly interested in applying some of the more, some of the newer, the relational ideas to a whole different area of experience, to creativity. The relational perspective on trauma, of course, takes into consideration the effects of early experience and attachment, and the impact of that on trauma. But I think that my book is more focused on bringing certain relational ideas like the concept of dissociation and witnessing into the self-expressive, into the artistic realm.
Yes, I mean, there's such great work in the book on some interviews that you've done with artists, and this idea of witnessing and kind of witnessing through art, if I'm reading it correctly, as a way of kind of dealing with trauma.
Yes, I feel that witnessing is very important in general. I think the need for recognition and to be known is a powerful universal need. But I think in the case of trauma, it's even more than imperative. I think that with trauma, there's a lot more conflict about it in terms of both wanting to disclose what has happened, and at the same time, a sort of internal injunction against revealing what has happened, connected up with a sense of shame. So there is a lot more conflict about it. That conflict is also universal, according to, Winnicott, likes to speak about that concept of both wanting to be found and the fear of being found. But I think it's even stronger with trauma survivors.
Yes. And what do you think traditionally the role of creativity or the place of creativity has been in analytic work over the years, and how, and I think you're speaking about one way that it has shifted, but has it always been, say, in the consulting room, has it always been part of psychoanalysis?
I think it has been a concept that people have been aware of, psychoanalysts have been aware of, but it has changed over time from something that had to do with sort of the inability to manage, or rather, let me put it this way, of taking aggressive and sexual impulses and transforming them into art, so that art sort of became like a substitute for something.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I do in the book is I trace kind of theoretical views and how they have changed over the years, from Freud's emphasis on art of sublimation, which was the main way of thinking about creativity in the consulting room and outside of the consulting room. But in later years, I traced through the interpersonal and humanistic and existential views about creativity, because for those theorists, creativity was an essential part of life. It was an example of the human capacity for growth,
mm-hmm.
Rather than a way of compensating for something that is lacking, which was the earlier view of sublimation as reparation. With them, it was more creativity as self-actualization. So, was that your question? I just want to make sure it's responding to the way you asked that question about the changes.
I think that's a key point about grappling with this idea of what traditionally has been sublimation, and mm-hmm. now kind of this idea of maybe a different idea, and maybe even something about maybe analytically about maybe co-constructing a creative act.
Yes. Well, that's certainly a more recent concept, and I don't write that much about co-construction and creativity, because what I focus on is creativity even outside of the consulting room. While I have a number of cases in the book where I discuss both the integration of the artistic form of self-expression into the sessions, bringing it into the sessions and making it a part of the therapy, much of what I write about is the way that people use the creative process outside of the consulting room.
Mm-hmm.
And people who might not go into therapy at all would be able to make use of it.
Yes, so it's creativity on its own can be a therapeutic process, I guess, is kind of the gist of it.
Yes, that's definitely what I believe.
Yeah, I know as one thing that's come up for me is creativity almost as a developmental process. Like getting a history of one's creativity has been very kind of important, and I think it's often a neglected area. What someone's early experience with music and art have been. And it often reveals a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I haven't thought of it as part of just a kind of an assessment. It usually will come into the sessions, and I don't use, you know, creative forms of expression as a technique or anything like that, you know, the way an art therapist might, for example. It sort of it evolves from the work that I'm doing with somebody, and I think I probably get a certain gleam in my eye when somebody mentions that, oh, they're writing or they're journaling or they're doing sketches, or and I think that sort of encourages the person to really talk more, and I will encourage them to talk more about something like that. So I think that I have a way of bringing it in without having it as part of a, you know, an assessment group. But I think you're quite right, because I think many people will do those creative things and not even think about them as creative. By the way, I probably should say something about the way that I define creativity and the way that I define trauma, which, because I think that, you know, I take a specific approach. You know, when I talk about creativity, I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, a great talent or a contribution to society. I'm talking about it's a broad definition of a potential in all of us, and I use the term artist loosely without judgment regarding the quality of the product. You know, it's like we some have defined it as little C versus big C, where little C is like tending to one's garden, or making wonderful meals without a recipe, or being creative with a recipe, and big C is like writing a symphony. So I'm really interested in a broad definition. And my definition of trauma, by the way, is also on a continuum from adversity and loss, which are universal, to catastrophic trauma, such as the Holocaust.
Yes, I mean, I think this is one of those, it's another topic that seems to come up from time to time about what constitutes trauma, as if there has to be a kind of a quantitative judgment or such about what trauma is, and that there is this continuum.
Yes, I definitely see it on a continuum.
And can you say something about the relationship between trauma and dissociation?
We know that one of the common defenses in trauma is dissociation. I know it from the inside out. I think, you know, I turned to that dissociation before I understood, you know, what that was. I mean, for example, I experienced a tremendous sense of numbness. It's not like I didn't remember what had happened to me, even though, you know, my memories were few because I was very young during the war. But it was, the feelings were disconnected from the actual event. So if I talked about my experiences, it was a little bit like a robot, you know. Mm-hmm. I talked about the facts, but the emotions seemed to be missing. And then in time, emotions sort of flooded, and so I would say a word, and suddenly I would start to tear, and it was that kind of disconnect. So I know about trauma and dissociation, but in the book, I use the concept of dissociation in relation to what happens in the artistic process, in the creative process. And that, I think, is relatively unique. I like to think that's my contribution, and my own view of the creative process, which is different from the way that, you know, I mean, as I say, there have been so many theories about creativity. But I feel that maybe the emphasis that I place on it is different. You know, you mentioned witnessing before, but that's one of the aspects. But the other is dissociation, and what I mean by that is that when the artist, you know, I have noticed, both from personal experience and also from interviews with artists, and I've been around artists for much of my life, and so I went to a special high school and went to high school of music and art, and I was an art major, and there was a time I thought that would be my career, but I shifted gears. Anyway, I noticed that when artists are deeply immersed in the creative process, they surrender to it, as Manning Gantz would say. They enter a kind of altered state of awareness. And in that state, they almost forget where they are, forget to eat, lose track of time, and become so absorbed as to be in another state. Csikszentmihalyi, who, by the way, wrote a lovely endorsement for my book, he wrote about the concept of flow. Well, this is very much like flow. I think flow is probably another word for that altered state, that what I call dissociation. And in that state also, judgment is put on hold. So there isn't a kind of evaluation that will sometimes be the blocking factor when someone is having creative blocks.
Yes.
And imagination is heightened. I'm also very familiar with that state because about 35 years ago, I trained in hypnosis at Columbia, and I used it as an adjunct. Through the years, I've used it as an adjunct. And I know that hypnotic state, that trance state, is very similar to what the artist experiences. And so, and I think that's one of the, you know, the creative process is not just inspiration. It takes more than inspiration, but this is the inspiration aspect of it.
Yes. What might you see, or what changes do you think you might see as a person progresses in treatment, or comes into dissociative state, or comes in with a history of trauma, and moves maybe towards more creativity? How would you see that progress?
I'm thinking that the creative individual really basically just may need a little encouragement. But, you know, someone who is, you know, dissociation happens on a continuum also. And I know that from my hypnosis training, where some people are very responsive to that state, and others are not. And so, but people who are who've been traumatized and have a tendency towards dissociation, basically have a tendency towards dissociation, and can make use of that capacity in the creative process. So, but all that they really, you know, in terms of progression you're talking about, I think that with a little encouragement, they can develop whatever propensity or talent, and by talent I don't mean necessarily a talent in the arts, but the talent for dissociation, that could be developed also.
Well, I do think of Sullivan, when Sullivan would talk about problems in living and how maybe there was something about making people more creative in living. Again, not to become an artist with a capital C, but to just to have a wider repertoire in a sense of living.
Yes. Well, of course, people like Otto Rank, who I think has really not been recognized sufficiently, were writing about this very early on, around the time of Freud. Rank was writing about the artist and about the capacity that all human beings have in being creative, and he was recognizing the importance of that, as were the existentialists.
Yes.
Recognizing that. So, I think that it is definitely something that is wonderful. And as a person is freed up, they can turn to whatever form of self-expression is natural to them.
Yeah, I think it's often, for me, one of the most striking aspects of our work when someone actually kind of becomes creative in some way, and saying whether it's cooking or gardening or something, or just a kind of a change in flexibility, and it's often a very profound shift in treatment.
Yes, yes. It can happen in treatment, or it can happen outside of treatment, but I think that freedom, greater ability to express the kind of the inner state is certainly encouraged through a good therapy.
There's also some writing in the book about neuroscience and some of the new neurological findings and how they relate to creativity and art.
Yes. Neuroscience is not... It's not a great interest of mine, but I was particularly fascinated by reading some of the work by someone by the name of Arne Dietrich,
yes,
who's a neuropsychologist, and his work was, he was very interested in creativity, he was very interested in flow, and in some of the states that one enters when one is doing exercise. And what he and other neuroscientists have found is that there are actually brain changes where the frontal lobes, during the creative process or during the slow process, the brain changes are that the frontal lobes are temporarily on hold, and thinking it becomes more meandering and less directed and more creative. And they have called this the transient hypofrontality hypothesis. And that means that the transient is that this is temporary, and the hypofrontality is that the frontal lobes are, they're like on hold. And it is, I think it's important to remember, it's a hypothesis. So much of what we're learning in neuroscience is really hypotheses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes people are very tempted to see, people who are looking for concrete facts are very eager to to find these solutions to our problems, but these are hypotheses for the most part. But it's a fascinating thing, and there are a lot of people are interested in the creative process from a neuroscience perspective as well.
Yeah. Also, I think there's so much in the book that's so it's actually quite a wide ranging book in many ways, and I think you address something that often doesn't get address so much, which is really the life stages and creativity through life, right?
I do feel good about that, and my last chapter really is about aging and creativity, and how confronting one's death is a stimulus to it can be an experience of trauma, basically. It's another kind of trauma, the losses that one experiences all around, and the prospect of death coming closer. And I think that for many, there's a desire for the generativity and to... Even, Rock talked about the immortality, the need for immortality as being very basic to the creative arts. And you can create something that lives on after you. So, I do believe, through one's life. And then in that chapter also, by the way, while I'm thinking of it, I'll mention it, I also talk about illness, severe chronic illness, which... has some similarities because it also brings one in a confrontation with death as well. And it certainly is a traumatic experience to be diagnosed with a severe illness.
Yeah, it does call to mind, certainly Erickson's work as well. And Maslow, I think it touches on kind of this idea of kind of what it means, the hierarchy of needs, and what it means to be, like you mentioned, the generativity of later life.
Yes, very much. The other person who had written about this quite a bit is Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself was an example of, someone who... into his later years was, continued to be immensely creative. I write about him. In fact, I devoted chapter to him because, his life is such a wonderful example of the theme that, I write about.
Yes, and I think he's really, many people have not... he's not always talked about, and certainly in relational circles as much, but you do a wonderful job on taking memories, dreams, and reflections and kind of moving forward with that and using him as an example.
That was his memoir, which someone wrote with him, but then as he was getting closer to his death, he actually almost took over the process. And I think he died in 61, and the book was published in 62, something like that,
mm-hmm.
1961 and 1962. So he was so engaged in that process of creating. And I talk about memoirs. I talk a lot about memoirs.
Yes.
Just having written one, I mean, and inspired by other people's memoirs as well, and that is a very important form of self-expression.
And also about Jung's Red Book, which is also a very interesting chapter, which just, I guess, came out in a new edition recently, if I'm not mistaken, but it's also quite an interesting take on that work by Jung.
Yes, he has such beautiful illustrations in there, amazing work, he was an artist, he was a painter, he's an artist, and that state that I talked about that the artist goes into,
mm-hmm.
He really describes that process, for himself. And he actually encouraged patients to do something very similar.
It's interesting. There's some talk in the book about Freud and also Freud's what Freud felt about art. And there was certain he liked certain forms of art, but he wasn't really a big music fan.
Right. I guess he wasn't. But in his inner circle, I think, I don't remember his name, but there was, perhaps you know it from your experience in music, that there was one of the, when the group, I think, was an expert on music and did write about music. But Freud himself, no, didn't seem to be.
And also, I guess that from the title, right? It's the, you also write about the muse and what's the purpose of the place of the muse.
Yes. Well, for me, the muse is a very important concept for my book, because I see the muse really as a kind of relational presence in what otherwise would be a solitary activity of making art. And I see it as an embodied image of another who serves a witnessing function and an inspiring function for the artist.
Yes, it's such
an... Sometimes we refer to muse, and I do in my dedication to my husband and my daughter as muses. But I think it's also an imaginary other who exists in that intermediate area of experience that Winnicott has so beautifully written about, that potential space between psychic reality and the outside world. And that's the way I conceptualize muse.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful formulation on inspiration and creativity to think of the muse in a relational aspect, not just something that kind of visits you or kind of hits you like lightning, but rather that you have a relationship with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really love that that concept.
And if you want to speak maybe more about how art can come out of, you know, your chapters on genocide and on kind of really severe trauma, and you spoke a little bit about it earlier, but maybe if you'd like to elaborate a little bit on people who create art out of that experience.
Yes. Well, I had a strong feeling as I was writing that chapter. I found myself really engaged in it, and it really developed a very strong feeling. And I think that the way that survivors are understood for the most part is really... survivors are not really understood, I feel. The theories about survivors are kind of counter to what I'm writing about, because I'm writing about art coming from a survivor of massive psychic trauma is a form of resilience. Not just massive psychic trauma. I think art is art in the context in which I'm using it is a form of resilience. And for the most part, this is very pathological lens through which people see survivors. A lot of that is the theories that have been repeated over and over again about what happens to survivors is that the primary and passive bond with a good internalized object is lost, and the internal representation of the relationship between self and other is destroyed. And as a result of that, there's a loss of the capacity to reflect, and a shutdown of processes of symbolization and integration, and all of that does not make sense to me. Now, I'm a survivor, my mother was a survivor, my father was a survivor, their friends were survivors, I was surrounded by a community of survivors, and this concept makes no sense to me.
Well, I think...
And actually, you know,
No, I was going to say that really through the book, taking these concepts that maybe were pathologized, even the idea of going into a flow state, may have been seen kind of pathologically earlier on, and turning them into really positive place in that, and that it really hasn't been your experience that these are that people don't have resiliency, that they're, that it's irreparable. And I think that really comes across very clearly in the book.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that feels very right to me. I've had difficulty with the kind of, you know, sweeping generalizations about survivors. And I feel that, you know, yes, of course, there's damage. Inevitably, there's damage. But there's also hope and growth and repair. I see a cardboard view of what survivors are like. And, you know, even saying they're amazingly resilient and being surprised by the resilience, it's problematic for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because why should we be surprised about resilience?
Right.
You know? So, I appreciate you saying that it's kind of to write the book. It's not just that I talk about that in that chapter about, genocide. But it is my view on life. I think people exist in multiple states. To me, the concept, you know, the relational concept of multiple states of self makes perfect sense. And, you know, I could see my parents, the objects in my life who both could be mourning and despairing and could also, you know, laugh and with abandon. My mother could do that, and my father, he wrote a memoir, and he painted, and those brought him so much satisfaction and pleasure. So, the feeling that I've had, it grows as I get older.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the idea of self-states and as a new way of kind of formulating what happens in trauma, what happens in survivors, and how it moves away from maybe some of the former conceptualizations, and what a useful concept it is.
Yes, it has always made a great deal of sense to me.
So the book is lovely. There's wonderful pictures in it, and I just wanted to comment too on the cover, which was by David Newman, who I also know, and it's just wonderful. And he has his own story of surviving that you mentioned in the book as well.
Yes. David is actually a wonderful example of what I write about. He is a painter, as you can see by that magnificent cover. And he's also a writer. He wrote about his trauma, which just briefly is a brain tumor, and the way that he was faced with having to make life and death decisions very quickly, and trying to find a surgeon. And his book, Writing, Talking with Doctors, is his book, is a memoir about that period of his life. He's a wonderful example of somebody who's been able to use his writing and his painting as ways of working through and finding some meaning
Well, one thing I was thinking about in my work when I was reading your book was I often work with with young people who are becoming artists, who are going out and artistically stuck or struggling with art and with making art and kind of maybe as a career choice, as a place to go. I was wondering if you had anything to add about that. I just was something that was of interest of mine.
In terms of how to encourage them?
Maybe to encourage or kind of to deal with the struggles that they work with as they kind of make choices and kind of have a maybe creativity that's been unrealized so far. It was just something that, mm-hmm. that seems to come up amongst a lot of young people, especially moving to New York. I see it often.
Well, it is a big struggle, and, I didn't go into painting, because one also has to be practical and make a living, and I think many of these young people are faced with that kind of choice, but I think that what I would say is one can always do the art, and I think that one can't always do, make a living at it, which is what these young people are probably struggling with, mm-hmm. but it can be very gratifying. One of the interesting things that I think that happens as you age, of course, telling the young people that is probably not relevant because it's hard for them to see what that will be like in time, but people do return as I did to the arts. So after 35 years of being away from painting, I came back to it, and then it felt wonderful. So that, you know, for somebody who is drawn to the arts, it's a wonderful thing to have, and one always has it. The talent doesn't go away, or the desire for it. If it's strong, it survives a lot. And in fact, a woman that I interviewed for a while, went into social work, and then returned to art. It's something that can be with you your entire life.
Well, as someone who has a guitar under his couch in his office, I can attest to that. So. we're coming up to the end of our 50-minute hour, so I just wanted to ask you if there's anything that I've left out or anything else you'd like to say about the book before we close. Anything I didn't get to?
I was thinking about what's the actual therapeutic action of art, and so I thought maybe I would mention that, mm-hmm. What happens with trauma is there's a sense of chaos often, and a kind of internal chaos, and what one is able to do through putting that into that kind of unformulated experience into some shape and form, and externalizing it into a work of art, which then sort of organizes the chaos, and it allows a person to do this by giving it some distance. It becomes more manageable, and to make sense of it and give it meaning. And of course, as I said before, creates the witnesses, both for the artist bearing witness to what he or she has experienced, but then also having others witness it, and that allows for the connection with others, which is usually something that's very much of an issue with those who've been traumatized. It's an empowering experience that brings self-esteem. So that's sort of what I wanted to talk about, what the therapeutic action of art is.
Yes, it's very important, and I'm glad that you were able to bring it up. And yes, that again, it ends it on a kind of a nice note of the relationship to art and the relationship is what kind of is helpful in healing.
Yes. Yeah. Also, you know, the one last thing is I just want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book. Even though talking is not easy for me, I'm really glad to have the opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Of course, yes, thank you. And hopefully we'll have you on next time when your next book comes out.
Not so fast. I want to go back into some painting now, which has been on hold for a while because I can't do everything.
We'll have your paintings on the podcast. We've been speaking with Dr. Sophia Richman, the author of Mended by the Muse, Creative Transformations of Trauma. This has been Christopher Bandini for New Books in Psychoanalysis.